Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I was always a dreamer. I always saw a life beyond the life that I had as a child.
It was like a big flashing light. This is what you're supposed to do.
Everybody poo-pooed the idea. Network said it couldn't be done.
You're in that zone, and it's that out-of-body experience where it just, everything clicks.
Sometimes you have those dark moments. I was so depressed when I got fired.
I was so mad.
People don't need to be afraid to fail. And again, that's where you learn. You shouldn't be afraid of adversity. You know, that is the thing that makes you strong.
This is Jerry Levias.
This is Jody Markell.
This is Chi Young.
This is Dick Vitale, and you're listening to American Achievers.
Welcome to American Achievers, the podcast that celebrates ambition, commitment to excellence, risk-taking, and tenacity on the road to success. I'm Keith Dunovant. Some of my guests are world-famous. Some are rather obscure. Our weekly lineup includes entrepreneurs, athletes, military heroes, civic leaders, artists, and media figures. What they all have in common is a sense of undeniable purpose and an intriguing story that reflects the power of the American dream. We all make choices, and we all must live with the consequences. No one understands this better than retired Air Force Brigadier General Norman Gattis. As a young man who volunteered for World War II, Gattis yearned to fly. It was initiative that landed him in pilot training, and skill and dedication that allowed him to become proficient in the cockpit. His career would be filled with adventure and purpose, including flying escorts in the Berlin Airlift and serving as a fighter pilot during the dangerous transition to jets. Years later, as a middle-aged man, he was settled into a desk job at the Pentagon when he volunteered for duty in Vietnam, eventually flying 72 successful combat missions in the F-4 Phantom. Choices, consequences. Gattis paid a high price for chasing his dream and honorably serving his country, including unspeakable pain. Join me for a two-part American Achievers interview with an American hero who is confined for 2,124 days in the North Vietnamese prison camp known as the Hanoi Hilton.
You grew up in the Depression, very tough time, on a farm in East Tennessee.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, my mother and father were both school teachers originally, and they taught in the area around Dandridge, Tennessee, and also in Sevier County. And so as the children, my older brother, 2 years older than I, was born, and then I was born after him, and then my sister came 3 years after that. So with three young children, they were not able then to continue on teaching school. And so they moved into Knoxville, Tennessee. And there they, at first, were in the textile business in the all of the things that go along with making shirts and shorts and things like this. And so that was their mode of earning money, is to work for the textile mills within Knoxville.
And it was a tough time to grow
yes,
up.
Yes, it was during the Depression, and this was in the mid-30s, and jobs were very, very difficult to come by. and they did not pay a great deal of money, and it was very, very difficult for families to hold themselves together in situations like that.
Did you worry about just surviving at that point?
No, I didn't. I had complete confidence that my family, our mode of living was commensurate with the money that they were earning. And although it was not a lot of money, it was just about the average that a family would earn during that time period. It was very, very, the mid-30s were very, very difficult for our country to get through that. And it's so just many of the programs that were put on by the government, by President Roosevelt and so forth, helped to turn the country around. It was just a tremendously hard time to rear a family. And that's, we were born, happened to be born during that time period. And of course, we lived through it.
What's the most important lesson you learned from your parents?
The most important lesson that I learned during all of that, and this was reinforced by my parents, that an education is the key to get us out of all of this dilemma that we're in. We should educate our people more and more and make it possible for them to go to school and to obtain jobs after they finish their college. That was the most important thing that my mother and my dad talked to me about, was get a college education.
Pearl Harbor affected everybody of your generation. What do you remember about it?
Well, I remember that we happened that Sunday, we happened to be up at my grandfather's up in Sevier County, and we were coming back into Knoxville, and we saw people holding up papers. And it was obvious that something was going on. And my dad stopped and bought a Sunday paper for 10 cents. And there was the story. The Japs had attacked Pearl Harbor and seriously damaged and destroyed our fleet out there. And it was obvious that this was something that they had been planning for some time. They didn't start planning this 2 weeks ahead. This had been coming on for a long time. But I guess we were just not aware of what was happening, at least down the average, averaged American family wouldn't. But the military people should have known better. I mean, to let something like that happen out at Pearl Harbor was a great blow to this country. And it awakened us to the point where we realized that now we're involved in a war. We will be involved in this war. And so we need to win the war.
Soon you found yourself in uniform. Tell me about how you got into the service.
My older brother Ralph, 2 years older than I, was drafted into the military. And the draft was a part of the American culture at that point in time. People were drafted to go into service, and I believe that the service commitment was 2 years. I believe that was right. But nevertheless, it just meant that we had to improve our ability to defend ourselves against countries like Japan, who was intent upon destroying us. And so on that particular Sunday, It was obvious that many people were going to be called into service. And so my brother was drafted into the Army, and I was a couple of years behind him in school. I asked my parents if I could join, and they hesitated. They didn't want me to join at that point in time, but later on, I convinced them that I would like to go into the Army Air Corps rather than just the Army. And so they consented, and about 2 years after my brother was drafted, then I went in to the United States Army Air Force.
Where did the ambition come to fly, to be an aviator?
They sent me to an Army airfield down in Florida, and I had never been around airplanes very much. I checked in there with them, and they gave me a job, and this job was to work on airplanes, be a technical person with repair to the airplanes. And so I didn't have any kind of a background in something like that. I relied upon the older people who were there to teach me about the airplanes. And then I had the nerve, along with many others, to ask if I could fly with one of the crews on one of their airplanes. And they allowed me to do that. I just felt that was wonderful. The interesting part of it was that while we were up flying, something happened at the base, and we could not land there. So we landed at the 36th Street Airport in Miami for maybe 2 to 3 hours until things got squared away up there. But once we got refueled and got cleared out to come back to the base, I thought that was what I would like to do. So I asked my supervisor, who was a staff sergeant, I said, I would really like to fly these airplanes. And he said, well,
What kind of plane was that at that point?
That was a B-26, Martin B-26. And he said, there is an office here, and you could go and talk with them. So I went to this office and said, is there a possibility that I might be able to go to flying school? And they said, yes, there is. And we want you to take a series of tests. I took the test, and I passed all of those. They said, now we will need to send you to a flight specialist, a medical doctor, and have him to check you over. So I went there and was told that, yes, you physically, you'd be ready to go. And also talked to the people who were in charge of the recruiting for flyers. And they said, well, you've met all of the requirements. What we would like to do would be to send you to Eau Claire State Teachers College in Wisconsin for 6 months of training. And I said, wonderful. So along with many others, I think there was probably 200 to 300 of us, we went to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and they still had the military part of it. We marched and did all of those things, but we also went to college courses for 6 months and passed all of that. And then from there, we were sent to Santa Ana, California. It turned out that at Santa Ana, they had 200 squadrons out there of pilots in reserve who were waiting to go to flying school. I was sent to flying schools in California. All of my training was in the first two went to primary in California. I finished up my flying in Arizona. And by this time, the number of people that had volunteered and so forth, they were in such a large number that they could not handle us all at one time. So they let us stay in college, take college courses, and then I had the opportunity to go through flying school. I passed all of the colors there and graduated then in 1944.
If you enjoy the podcast and would like to access our exclusive premium content, visit AmericanAchievers.us and hit the premium membership button. Special thanks to Gold Achievers Wayne Atchison, Courtney Caramico, and Ross Stewart. Check out my books, including definitive biographies of Paul Bear Bryant, Joe Montana, and Francis Gary Powers at KeithDonovan.com or your favorite bookseller. My latest, Speed, Test Pilot Bob Gilliland and the Development of the SR-71 Blackbird Spy Plane. Now back to the program. What do you remember about your first solo? Was it memorable?
Well, I had three flights with my instructor, and he gave me all of the pointers on flying an airplane, how to fly the airplane and when to fly the airplane and when you're getting into trouble and things like this. So we flew the whole class. We had, 70 hours of flying time. About half of it was with an instructor. Half of it was by ourselves. So we went through primary, basic, and then advanced. We reached the advanced stage, and the commander there happened to be a colonel from Tennessee, and he called us all together for the theater, and we went there, and he said, "Men, I have some news for you. Some of you will say that it's bad news. Others will say it's good news." But he said, we have produced so many pilots that we have a surplus right now. And so we're going to continue to let you fly for another month. And so I picked up 30 more hours of flying time. And that was most helpful. And it is true that during the latter part of the war that we were producing more pilots than we actually needed. And as a result of that, they put us doing different things, but I managed to continue to fly. By this time, I was flying P-40s and P-51s and considered myself to be, you know, absolutely the very finest pilot in the world.
Now, two things. One, don't you have to have that feeling if you're a pilot?
Yes.
Don't you have to be a little bit cocky to be a good pilot?
You do. You have to be cocky, and you have to realize that you're going to have, at times, you'll have serious problems, and you need to stay with the airplane and work out that problem and then come in and land. And so it was wonderful to get this extra flying time, because that gave us the opportunity to build up more experience.
Have you ever considered that, going back to that moment when you kind of raised your hand and you said, "Hey, what would it take for me to fly one of these things?" Your whole life pivoted on that initiative.
Yes, yes.
Have you ever considered that?
No, I never. You know, I just felt that, you know, whatever situation I could get into, that I could get out of it. I was not one to take chances. I like to do acrobatics. And I also like to do what we call air-to-air combat. This is simulated flying one airplane against another to see which theoretically could shoot the other airplane down.
But what I meant was that moment when you went in to say, hey, I'd like to be a pilot, that changed your life.
That did.
Fundamentally.
That changed my life totally. I never ever dreamed that I'd have the airplane, and you know, have the opportunity to fly the airplanes that they let me fly. And I just, you know, thanked, not to be downgrading my brother. My brother was in the infantry, and I didn't want to be in the infantry. I didn't want to be in...
What was it about flight that attracted you at that point?
I guess it was just the idea of I'm out here by myself. I'm doing things with this airplane. I'm learning things with this airplane that will probably be a benefit to me later on. And just, I can recall being down in Florida flying around and through these tremendous storms that they have down there. And just to see this little airplane going between these cells, all of this, that it was so fantastic. You know, I couldn't believe that here, or in a matter of 3 years or 2 years from the time I began, that I was flying airplanes like that.
And can you explain to the layman the rush that you felt commanding an airplane like that?
Well, it was just, it just left you with a sort of a weak feeling. You know, you were so thrilled with the idea that that's an airplane. I can make that airplane do almost anything I want to, but it does have limits. And I don't want to exceed those limits, but you can go and do all of the flying, do all of the acrobatics that you would like to do. But again, against all of that, you've got to figure out that, hey, there could be something that would cause some problems for me and for the airplane. And so,
what was the most challenging part of flying in combat?
The most challenging part of combat was to be leading a flight of four airplanes. Usually fighter airplanes fly in flights of four. And at first, you're the low man on the totem pole. You're the last guy. Then you prove yourself to yourself and to other people that you have the ability to fly the airplane and command the airplane. And as you move on up into it, you become the flight leader. And then you have three other people who are dependent upon you, on your decisions, on your actions. And that's where it gets a little bit tough, because you run into situations, weather situations, which some of them were pretty violent, and to be going through those things. We should have gone around them instead of flying into these.
No radar in those days.
There was no radar. But and the other thing, I always, always concerned about the people who were flying with me. They were hanging on to me as their leader. And so I wanted to lead them safely. Whatever we did, I wanted to get them back on the ground safely.
What did it take? What characteristics did it take to be a successful fighter pilot?
I would say, of course, flying the airplane and you're flying against another airplane, that is one of the things that you're concerned with, you know, your ability to go against another airplane head to head and see who's going to win that. And over a period of time, over maybe 10 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes, you've gone through so many acrobatics, so many maneuvers doing that, that that is just a way of life with you.
Did you feel the adrenaline pumping?
Oh, yes.
What was that like?
Well, I'll tell you, when we came down from flying, our flight suits were wet with perspiration. And the helmets were also wet. I mean, it causes a lot of perspiration. You'd just be surprised at getting one against one, you know, and these are your friends that you're flying against, but this is training. And that's the way it was over in Vietnam. It was fantastic over there. The pressure that I felt every time I went up with three younger men.
Now, what was it in you that made you want to take on that pressure?
Well, I wanted, first of all, to lead these young men in the flight, three other people, and to demonstrate to them how we would attack the problem, how we would go against, if it's a bombing mission's one thing, if you're a fighter versus fighter, it's another thing. If you're just there in terms of what we call recce, looking around, waiting to see what you can find.
After World War II ended,
yes,
you ended up in college at the University of Tennessee.
Yes.
And then you got a phone call or something.
Yes, I was called to active duty because when I left the service, I agreed that if they needed my service, that I would return.
And you wound up in the Berlin airlift.
I ended up by flying with the cargo airplanes as they took off from, say, Wiesbaden with a load of coal and took it into Tempelhof. We would fly two fighters on each side and take them up. We did that simply because the Soviets were making passes at those airplanes, going in front of them.
Now, for those uninitiated, let's set it up here for a second. In 1948, the Soviets closed the highway and railway approaches to Berlin.
Right.
And so you had a couple of million people starving to death.
Yes.
And what did we do? What did we do as the Allies?
We, along with the Allies, formed the Berlin Airlift. And I'm trying to think at the moment. The officer, well, I'm not quite certain who formed the idea, but they came up with a plan that we would fly cargo airplanes solo, but there would be a space between them. And the reason being, landing at Tempelhof Airport, there were only so many places you could park the aircraft on the ground until they unloaded the airplane. Then it would take off and go back. So our job was to fly along to see that the Soviets did not fly in front of, down below, and come up in front of these.
Because they were harassing our pilots.
They were harassing. And our job was just to show them that they were not supposed to be doing that. And it was successful. I don't know of a single airplane that they shot down or a single U.S. airplane that was lost because of the Soviets' activity.
This was a key moment. This was us calling the Soviets a bluff.
Right.
And it was essentially the first battle of the Cold War.
Yes, yes. It was interesting. I did have the opportunity to fly as co-pilot on one of the C-54s. We landed in Tempelhof, and we had 7 tons of coal in the airplane. They were so efficient at unloading that within a matter of just minutes, they unloaded that because it was in, they were bags of coal. They took all of that off of there. They had a weather person standing there with the weather report, what it would be like going back. They cleaned the airplane, spick and span, vacuumed all of that extra coal that had fallen out of there, and we turned and came back. That was the only flight that I had in the C-54.
Now, what if one of those Soviet airplanes had shot at you? What were you supposed to do?
We were supposed to shoot him down. We were authorized if he were endangering any of our airplanes, we were authorized to shoot them down.
And you knew what that meant?
Yes, yes.
That was World War III right there.
Yes, yes, so to speak, it was. It was. But they barely on their left, I think, is one of the great stories of our time as far as us providing assistance to the people of Berlin who were being starved to death by the Soviets. They closed road traffic, and air was the thing that was bringing them their food, their medicine, their coal.
Yeah. What do you think that effort said about American resolve?
It demonstrated to me, at least, that we had the courage to tell the Soviets, this is not right. You can't do that. You are starving people. You would be starving people if you could. And we're not going to let it happen. We're not. We are a friend of the people in Berlin that are in our section of Berlin. And we're just not going to let you do that to them. And General LeMay had a lot to do with that, and I don't know if you recall General LeMay, but he was one tough hombre. Let me tell you, he'd take that cigar and talk to you. He was one tough guy, and that's what it took to prove to the Soviets that we were not going to let them starve the people in Berlin, and we were going to take food, clothing, we were going to take coal, going to take everything that we could take in there. And it was just one of the wonders of the world, so to speak, the amount of equipment and substance and everything else that we took in there for the people in Berlin.
You're listening to American Achievers. Stay tuned for more conversation.
You came along at an interesting time in aviation, right on that transition between props and jets.
Yes.
And you got to fly one of the first jets, and there were a lot of problems with the F-84, weren't there?
Yes, there were.
A lot of people died flying that plane.
Uh-huh. It was not a very reliable airplane. The engine was the greatest problem. And they lost a lot of airplanes.
And you ended up being stationed at Neubiberg in West Germany. Tell me about that.
Yes. Well, we were I went to Newburgh in 1949, and we still had the old P-47s there then. But within about 6 months, they began to move in the jet airplanes, and it was a slow process of us trying to train people from conventional airplanes to jet airplanes.
And then there were so many differences, right? The fact that, first of all, it was a lot faster.
Yes.
You had to be much quicker mentally, right?
Right. Much quicker. Much quicker. And so it was a process of slowly training all of our people who had been flying propeller-driven airplanes to fly the jet airplanes.
How would you explain that transition for someone who just really can't even imagine that all these years later?
Well, it just took longer to learn how to fly the jet than it did to fly a conventional airplane. And if you had one that was prone to engine failures, and that was probably what our biggest problem was, engine failures on the jet airplanes.
And I remember you telling me one time that there were so many pilots dying at that base that they would name a street after a pilot, and they ran out of streets.
And that's true. First and Fellbrook and Newburgh back in those days. Yes, yes. Now, there was just more people. Now, Newburgh had the jets, but they also had some problems, but there were nothing in comparison to Newburgh flying these older planes and then converting to the latest jet airplanes that were not unreliable, but they were just not well built, and they would not stand up under a lot of heavy flying and so forth. And there's quite a difference between flying the old propeller-driven airplane and the jet airplane. There's a lag time when you push the throttle up on a jet. You have to wait for that jet engine to come up to full speed. In the fighter, with the propellers, as you push the throttle up, then the propeller began to run faster. Immediately, you had a response. But jet airplanes are not that way. So they trained us so that, okay, just don't get yourself into the situation where you're needing power and you can't get that power.
And some of those early Allison engines had a tendency to blow up.
They did.
And what do you do in that situation? What are your options?
Well, the option, if you still can control the airplane, you can try to do what we call a dead stick landing. And this is to, first of all, to call an emergency and then make up your mind what you're going to do. If you can glide the airplane over an airfield, then at a decent altitude, then you can land without having the full benefit of the engine itself. And so it was up to the pilot on what he wanted to do. A lot of them chose simply to bail out of the airplane. And back in those days, we didn't have the ejection seats that they have now. So there's the problem of, first of all, releasing the canopy so that it flies away from the airplane, and then getting yourself out of the airplane so that you could open your parachute. A lot of people like to do it by rolling upside down and just taking the seatbelt out and flying, dropping out of the airplane, so to speak. So,
literally flying by the seat of your pants.
Yes, Definitely, definitely. And if the jet engines slowly became more reliable.
Did you understand when you're going through this, one, that you're taking your life in your own hands, that the odds were not good on a daily basis?
Right.
And two, that you and your fellow pilots, you were inventing a new way of flying. Uh-huh. You were on this frontier.
Uh-huh. Yes. And so it was totally different to go from the propeller-driven airplane to the jet airplane. Totally different in terms of of the thrust that was available and how that thrust came in, whether you could push the throttle up and have a lot of power, or whether you had to wait for the engine to come up to full speed. So it was a different, and part of our training program had to do with in-flight failures, where we would glide the airplane over the field, have the power pull back all the way back, call the tower and ask them if I can do a dead stick landing. And the tower, according to the number of airplanes that they had flying, they would give you an opportunity, yes. So you practice engine failure on those airplanes. But the engines now, the jet engines now, are much more reliable. More reliable and more powerful. And
you ever wish you could go up in a jet today with all the bells and whistles they have? Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah.
You wound up at the Pentagon basically with a staff job.
Two times.
Yeah. So, I mean, tell me about that. Because you thought your fighter pilot career was over, right?
Yes, I thought it was over. I knew that the time would come when I would need, if I were going to progress within the Air Force, I needed to go through the service schools. And that was something that either the personnel department would take a look at your record and so forth and counsel you on that, or whatever the case might be. And so I had been a pilot and a wingman. I had been a leader of up to a flight of four. I had been an operations officer for a squadron. And then for the last 2 years of my life, I was at, not my life, last 2 years of of flying airplanes, I was at Williams Air Force Base as the operations officer for the Fighter Weapons School, a school where we trained a lot of pilots in how to use the different weapons that we had, the air-to-ground weapons, the air-to-air weapons, and all of that. And I realized that they were not going to let me go through 30 years of flying airplanes. So I decided then that, okay, I would ask, when the time came, I would ask the personnel people, you know, is there a vacancy in these different schools that I had to go through? And they would caution me. So the first one was to go to Air Command and Staff School, and this was at Maxwell Air Force Base. So it was a one-year school. We had Air Force, Navy. We had a few Navy people. We had some Army people, and we had several foreign officers who were with us there. I think there was, our class size was about 1,000 people. And it was 1 year long. So I finished all of that, And I didn't have any choice. My next choice was made by the personnel people. They said, you're going to the Pentagon to operations for 4 years. And so I did. I went there and got a tremendous education on how the Air Force programs all of its assets and distributes those assets and the training and so forth that's involved in it. A lot of it was just academic, but nevertheless, it was important. Maybe even going to the chief of staff of the Air Force with a problem, saying, sir, we have a problem. This is the problem, and that kind of thing. So after I finished that command and staff school, I was sent then to the National War College. This is the highest level of our schools, and consisted of Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, State Department people, people from most of the different activities within the United States government. Had 120 people in the school, and it was a wonderful education.
And you were training to be a high-level Pentagon officer, were you not?
Yes, I was.
You had no really thought that you were ever going to be in combat again?
No, I felt that I needed to have that, so I had that. Then I, after finishing up 1 year there, I was scheduled for an overseas tour, so I accepted a tour to go into Vietnam. And once I went into Vietnam,
That was optional. Huh? That was an optional. That was a choice that you made, right?
Yes, yes.
You were how old at that point?
I was 43. But I knew that, you know, there was a war going on. I had not been in any wars. I knew that if I were to advance, I needed to have some experience. That was what I wanted to do, was to go and do that. And so when they told me that there was the course that I could go through to fly the F-4 airplane, I said, I'd love to go.
Tell me about the Phantom. What kind of airplane was that?
The Phantom is a beautiful, beautiful airplane. It was developed by the Navy. It was modified by the Air Force and became one of our best, I think, tactical airplanes.
How much progress had we made between the F-84 and the F-4?
Oh, boy. Tremendous. Tremendous progress. Yes, tremendous.
We're talking about basically a decade, a little more than a decade.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, electronics has came into the equation, and so many of our airplanes today, munitions and everything else, all sort of tied together with an electronic in an electronic bond. group, and so you needed to know how to bomb with the airplane, how to go air to air against other airplanes, how to fly day and night with the airplane, all of those things, very, very important. And so I just felt that I needed to get that. So when my assignment came out, I was scheduled to go to Cameron Bay in Southeast Asia as the operations officer. And when I arrived there, I realized that they had an operation that went on 24 hours a day, and one person could not handle all of that. I worked out an arrangement with another one of my friends who was in the National War College with me. that he would have the responsibility for all of the daytime operations. I would have the responsibility for all of the nighttime operations. And which meant that after I finished up my tour duty, then I could have breakfast and maybe get a couple of hours of sleep and then fly combat missions.
How long did it take you to understand that we were in a very different kind of war in Vietnam?
Yes. It was quite different. We didn't know really who was our enemy and where they were hiding. And we just didn't know. And it was an unusual type of warfare that was going on.
Did you get discouraged about it?
I did, yes, I did. When I could see all of those young men, you know, many of them with their arms and legs blown off and and heading back, and there was just a lot of misery associated with that. When you'd have 100 people on that airplane and so many of them had nurses on the airplanes with them, and to get those people out and get them back to a hospital where they could be operated on. Sometimes they only went down to the Philippines to drop off people there at the hospital. Others required specialized training, specialized medical facilities and so forth. And so we, based upon the commander, the hospital commander, he made the decision where to go. I made it possible for him to have the airplanes so that when he was ready to move these people out to the hospital, that he was not delayed in any way by fighters' airplanes.
You flew 72 successful missions.
Yes.
On the 73rd mission, May 12, 1967, take me through that day.
Yes, I had flown up to Da Nang to have lunch with a friend of mine who was the operations officer, Colonel Blessé. And when I arrived up there, Blessé told me that he was scheduled for a very special mission that day. They had modified one of the airplanes and they had placed a gun on the centerline station. And for the first time, they were going to take that gun up to North Vietnam to see if they could shoot down an airplane with that. The F-4 did not have a gun in it. It was strictly for the Navy. The Navy didn't see that it was an air-to-air aircraft, but Colonel Blessé wanted to do that. And so when I landed, he was just coming out, and he said, "Hey, Norm, I want you to go with me." And go where? And he said, "On this mission with me. I've got the gun, it's squared away, we're ready to go." And I said, "Well, give me a few minutes here to close out my clearance and so forth and get ready to go." So I was assigned a young man as my backseat man, graduate of the Air Force Academy. Real nice young man, and he said, "I will, since I've been flying with him for quite some time, if you don't mind, I'll tell you what all's going on so you understand." So he was a tremendous help to me. And we took off. There was a lot of confusion. Colonel Blessé got up and he said, "Hell, the airplane's not working. I'm going to have to go back." And so he turned and we headed back toward Da Nang, got about halfway back there, and he said, "No, I've got it working now. Let's go back again." So we turned and went back again, just the two of us. And we joined up with another large group that had 12 people in it, and we tacked on to the back of them. We were hiding back here got up there. The 12 ships that were ahead of us, they went on to strike their target, and then we split out. So about the time we split out, he accelerated away from me, and I told him, I can't stay with you. I can't stay with you. And I was lagging back behind, and the next thing I know was that I heard that, hey, we have some people shooting at us, and I began to look around and finally realized that, hey, they had hit my airplane.
And you were how far up at that point?
Oh, at that time, we were in North Vietnam, maybe 50 miles.
And your altitude was what?
Altitude was probably somewhere around 30,000 feet. And so as we went on up, the bombers went ahead, and I tried to stay with him. Then suddenly the leader, he saw some of the airplanes, North Vietnam airplanes, and he accelerated to them, didn't tell us what was happening. So we lost space with him, just Colonel Blessé and I was hanging on for dear life because I think he was flying, Blessé was flying as fast as he could go. And suddenly I felt something hit the airplane, and I looked out, and there was a missile had exploded out to the left of the airplane. And part of that was sucked into the left engine, and that caused the left engine to explode. And when it exploded, I told the man in the back seat, "Get out." I heard the canopy go off. The next thing I heard was the seat gone. And by this time, I was upside down and at about 1,000 feet above the ground. And so I blew myself out. I just barely got squared away and I hit the ground. I landed fairly close to the Vietnamese. They had their rifles with them. So they just came at me from different points.
Did you assume you were a dead man at that point?
No. I held up my hand I just said, you know, I'm not going to pull out my pistol and try to shoot down all of these people. There was just no way that I could.
What's going through your mind at that point?
Well, the only thing is to survive that thing so that they didn't start shooting at me on the ground. And I just let them know that, you know. And so they came. They took my gun. They took my, let's see, what else did they take? They took the gun and my helmet that I had on. And they took me over to a wooded area, put me under a tree, and I waited there for maybe 2 hours, thinking, you know, what happened? Did they find my other crew member? And they finally came back. They showed me his name tag. They had cut his name tag out of his flying suit. They also had his helmet, and they also had his clipboard that had all of the flight information on it. None of those things had any blood on them. So I made the assumption that this young man got out of the airplane and had died. I didn't know what happened to him. And when I began to question them, try to say, you know, where is my backseater, they finally took a gun and put it to my head. And I realized that now is not the best time to try to, you know, make these guys angry.
Thanks to Lane McGivney and all the good folks at Boutwell Studios for all the TLC required to bring this podcast to life. And audio engineers Joe Beeman and Jonathan W. Hickman. Remember, everyone has a special talent. You just need to identify it, cultivate it, and be willing to pay the price. You too can become an American Achiever.